And once again, it's time for another edition of Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. My name's the V-Man, and on today's program, we'll take a look back at the 3 years of Palestinian uprising, Intifada II. I'll be speaking with Palestinian journalist and director of the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, Daoud Kutab. Stand by, stay tuned for Rockin' the Boat, coming up next. In a provocative display of force meant to assert Jewish sovereignty, 3 years ago on September 28, 2000, Ariel Sharon, at the time a right-wing Israeli opposition leader, along with about 1,000 armed Israeli troops, paid a visit to Islam's third holiest site, Al-Haram al-Sharif. This angered Palestinians, who, by most accounts, spontaneously held raucous demonstrations the next day. Israel's military response was to open fire on the protests, killing 7 unarmed Palestinians. This began the uprising, commonly referred to as the Al-Aqsa Intifada, which has led to the deaths of more than 2,600 Palestinians and at least 850 Israelis. Today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll examine the origins of the Second Intifada, international press reporting on the uprising, and how to move towards a peaceful resolution of the conflict. My guest is Daoud Kutab, a well-known Palestinian journalist who, since 1980, has fought for a free media in Palestine under both the Israeli occupation and the Palestinian Authority. Daoud Kutab was the first Palestinian journalist to conduct exclusive interviews with Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres, as well as other Israeli leaders. His reports have sparked the ire of both Israeli officials as well as the Palestinian Authority. Despite attempts to have him silenced, Daoud Kutab fearlessly carries out his mission to aid the development of an independent Palestinian press and has been awarded numerous times for his courageous work. In 1996, he founded the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Ramallah, and in 1999, he created the first internet radio station in the Arab world, AmanNet. Daoud Kutab's writings appear in a wide range of publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Haaretz, the Jordan Times, the Jerusalem Post, to name a few. Daoud Kutab joins us by phone on Rockin' the Boat from Amman, Jordan. I welcome you to the program, Daoud Kutab.
Thank you.
Why don't we begin with a bit of a discussion about the origins of the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Graham Usher, a writer with The Economist magazine, writes, "The Al-Aqsa Intifada was born of a collision between two national wills. On the one hand was an Israeli-determined peace process whose cumulative impact, with every passing year, became experienced by Palestinians as a new form of colonial dispossession. On the other was a collective understanding fueled by the mounting sense of Palestinian distress by Fatah's younger West Bank and Gaza leaders that unless a challenge was mounted soon to Israel's deepening occupation, their own future claims to leadership would be dashed." What do you make of this this writing by Graham Usher, and what are your thoughts on the three-year anniversary of the start of the Intifada?
Well, I think there is a number of ways to look at what happened. There isn't any single issue that one can point to, but certainly a combination of issues that have happened both in the years before and in the months before led to what happened. And before, I would say the failure of the Oslo process to take hold and for the idea of the Oslo process, which was a two-state solution, to really take into effect because settlement building continued during this whole period. And I would say in the short term before, the months before, the introduction by Ehud Barak of the idea, the unprecedented introduction of the idea of the need for Israel to have sovereignty over the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Haram Sharif, which was unprecedented since 1967, introduced a religious element into what we've always tried to look at this as a political conflict. And then Sharon's visit, you know, exaggerated or really heightened the fear and the worries of Palestinians that this is going to become a religious issue. And I think that's the main reason why we see the Intifada going for so long, despite so much loss of life, is that there is an introduction of a really emotional issue, which is a religious one.
Hmm. Oftentimes in the press here in the U.S., we get a picture of the situation as if it's pretty much a one-sided affair, that the Palestinian side is the cause of all the violence. Yet the numbers tell a different story. As I mentioned in the intro, at least 2,600 Palestinians have been killed in the ensuing violence over the past 3 years. For one example of the press reporting, today, Sunday's San Francisco Chronicle has a story on the three-year anniversary of the Intifada, and the way it's framed, we hear about the Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat as being the sole source and the cause of the Intifada. What do you make of the press reporting that you see in the Middle East on the situation?
Well, there is a fact that the Israeli killings take place on a almost a regular daily basis. But normally, or usually, they are, if I can use the term, in small numbers. So you have one killed here, two killed there, three killed here, four killed there. And often that doesn't produce the kind of interest among Western media as the attacks on Palestinians go and do the suicide bombings, which are much more dramatic. There are many more people who are killed. And so that triggers news stories and news coverage, and the others just don't get covered. Even though, as you said, in reality, the numbers of the Palestinians killed are much more, and the effect of the oppression on Palestinians as a whole is much deeper and much wider. Unfortunately, the press, especially the Western press, doesn't look at many aspects of the Israeli activities, the closures, the restrictions of movement, the house demolitions, the assassination attempts and assassinations in general. So there is a lot of social and economic effects that happen all the time to a whole large number of people, but are mostly not so tangible as a suicide bombing, which 10 or 15 Israelis get killed.
Last week on National Public Radio, they had an interview with a columnist from the LA Times, and he made the claim that the Intifada started after negotiations broke off at Camp David in July of 2000. And he points to the refusal of Arafat to accept this, quote, generous offer that was made by Barak at the time, Israel's prime minister. What can you talk about this quote-unquote generous offer that was made to the Palestinians at Camp David and why Arafat might have refused it?
Well, normally in normal society, somebody is generous when they are offering something of their own to somebody else. I don't think the term generous can be applied when somebody has taken away something and is giving part of it back. I don't think the terminology is the correct terminology. But guards in a prison can control 5% of the prison, and the inmates can be in 95% and control it, and yet they're still in the prison. So numbers and issues of percentages often are belied by the realities on the ground, and the fact is the Barak government made a, I would call it, unprecedented offer. Yes, this was the first time an Israeli prime minister made that kind of offer. That is true. But to say that returning occupied territories that the United Nations Security Council Resolution 242 said must be returned, that it is inadmissible to occupy land by force. So when the UN says that's inadmissible, you're supposed to return it, and you start returning parts of it, and you keep the parts, and you divide the country into regions, and so on and so forth, that is not a generous offer. But, you know, I'm not sure that the triggering of the Intifada is connected directly to the failure of the peace talks. I think the failure of the peace talks, as I told you earlier, had with it the Israeli introduction of the religious element, of touching a very, very sensitive subject, which is the sovereignty over al-Haram al-Sharif, and then the tangible physical appearance by Sharon on the same location as a way to reinforce the Israeli position. I think a combination of that plus the years and years of patience in which Palestinians have been waiting for a fulfillment of the Israeli Israeli obligations of the Oslo process, namely stop building settlements to get out of the occupied territories. When that has been failing for years, plus the religious element, I think that helped break the Intifada. Hmm.
You wrote in a recent piece titled "Who Won in Al-Aqsa Intifada," you write at the end, quote, "To be honest, I would say that the Palestinians have lost the latest round in points rather than through a knockout, which means that they still have a chance to regroup themselves. This means that national unity must be preserved at all costs. Palestinians must be careful not to fall in the trap of a civil war or a leadership struggle, and at the same time try to agree on an honest evaluation of what is possible in the current political landscape." Can you expand on this thought a little more for our listeners?
Yes. One of the problems we have in moving from the violent to the political arena is the fact that both Israelis and Palestinians have different interpretation as to where we are today. Palestinians, or some Palestinians, have a feeling that they haven't been defeated, and therefore, in a way, they've been successful. Israeli military people say the Palestinians have been defeated, and therefore we can dictate to them the terms of whatever settlement we want. And my argument is that neither side has won. Both sides have lost. Certainly the people have lost. And what we need to reach a realization of is that neither side can clearly win in this unwinnable war. Palestinians are not going to disappear, and the Israelis are not going to disappear. Both have proved in the last 3 years that as bad as it hurts, as bad as it is difficult and problematic, that they are standing on their land, they're standing on their positions, and that the violent military attempts to crush the other side has failed. And so I compared it to two boxers who are in the 100th round or so, both completely exhausted, but neither is willing to throw in the towel. And I'm saying we need an external outside party to come in and help us out to say, you guys, stop it. Take a rest, both of you, and let's find a sensible solution to this conflict.
The United States has tried to play that role of this sort of outside arbiter. Yet, with the U.S. constantly sending financial aid, military arms to Israel, and the U.S. playing with, being obviously the most powerful nation on the earth, militarily, economically, what then would be that outside arbiter? What would that be made up of, and how would that look like on the ground?
Well, the Democratic nominee for president said that there should be even-handedness in the Middle East peace conflict, all hell broke loose and they started attacking him. So there's clear lack of symmetry or neutrality in the U.S. position. But despite this clear bias towards Israel, Palestinians are realize this, and they're saying, we understand that you have a special relationship with Israel, yet we still accept you as an arbitrator on one condition, that at least you say what you mean what you say, and you say what you mean. And when the U.S. says stop settlements, at least they should be able to have the strength enough to cajole and to encourage the Israelis to carry out that request to stop building settlements. But if the Israelis continue to build settlements and they ignore the advice of even their friends, well, then I think the U.S. is betraying the support that they have from Palestinians, who clearly realize they are weak in the relationship with the U.S., and they still accept the U.S. as an arbitrator. But as long as the U.S. honors its own words, the U.S. led the quartet into issuing the roadmap, which says settlement building must stop immediately. It says no more settlements, no more walls, no more even settlement expansion for geographical or natural growth. America said that clearly in the roadmap. Yet on the ground, every day we're still seeing settlements are being built. So there is a clear violation, in-your-face type of violation, and the U.S. is quiet. Another thing, you have this assassination policy going on. It's an extrajudicial, immoral, illegal activity, and the U.S. is quiet. And who is criticizing it? Israelis. 27 Israeli air pilots have issued a statement saying that we are going to stop doing this because it is immoral and illegal. It's a real shame that the Israeli pilots would say this, and the State Department of the United States, the most powerful country in the world, the country that's built on morals and on internationally accepted values and human rights, has refused to say that this is immoral and illegal. So the U.S., even in its bias, is still biased.
You're tuned to Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. My name's the V-Man, and my guest is Palestinian journalist and director of the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, Daoud Kutab. We're speaking by telephone. He's joining us from Amman, Jordan. Daoud, we hear a lot about Palestinian resistance movements and the violent aspects of it, but we almost never hear about the Palestinian peace movement and the nonviolent resistance there. Can you talk a bit about some other strategies that are being employed to resist the occupation?
You are absolutely right. This is one of the biggest problems we have, is the fact that a tremendous wide amount of activities are going on almost on a daily basis, and it isn't reported. In fact, we've created a website called PalestineNet.org, which is supposed to become a site that specifically documents nonviolent protest activities. But, you know, also on this field, the U.S. has been quiet. There is a group of international volunteers in the international solidarity movement who have come to the occupied territories to show support and witness with the Palestinians. And the Israelis have been deporting them, arresting them, putting them in jail and harassing them. And again, the U.S. government is quiet about people who are completely committed to nonviolent activities with the Palestinians. And it is real shame. You know, there was one case which got some publicity of Rachel Corey, who was bulldozed by an Israeli bulldozer. Yet, you know, other than that case, there is almost daily acts of Israeli intervention and physical abuse towards Palestinian, Israeli, and international nonviolent protesters. And it rarely gets covered in the press.
What impact do you think that the international, as you point out, the ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, what impact do you think they have on the soldiers? Do they act differently when there are internationals around, or is it just, do they kind of ignore the presence of internationals?
Well, there is no doubt that the Israeli soldiers act differently when there are cameras, when there is internationals available. And that's why the Israelis have created a whole bunch of laws and regulations that at times ban internationals from even entering into Israel, and some of them are banned from entering the occupied territories. And whenever they can, the Israelis, arrest them and deport them. And we have a real problem in just simply having the ability to allow these people to stay around, because we know that when they are around, the Israelis get all flustered and they don't know how to act, because they are used to their normal oppressive actions against Palestinians, who are usually helpless without anybody watching or observing or telling it like it is.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the breakdown of the roadmap. Recently, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, stepped down as the prime minister of the Palestinian people, and we now have Ahmed Korea, also known as Abu Allah. What is the likelihood that his reign or his rule will fare any better than Abbas?
Well, I don't know. He has one thing for him and many things against him. What he has for him is that the charade of a difference between the prime minister and the president has now gone. There's no more attempt to have a prime minister who has a political difference or politically different outlook than the president. And this was all a charade, because it really was done to help the Israelis climb down the tree that they climbed up. The Israelis said, we don't want to talk to Arafat. And for months and months and months, ever since Sharon was elected into the prime ministry about 2.5 years ago, the negotiations completely broke down. There has not been any negotiations because Sharon said, I will not talk to Arafat. So everybody scratched their head and said, how can we go around this? And they found, you know, this idea that Palestinians had offered a long time ago of creating the office of prime minister. So we said, oh, this is a way to help, you know, the Israelis overcome their own, you know, a charade of saying we don't want to talk to Arafat by creating the office of the prime minister. For Palestinians, this was not an attempt to divert or alternate leadership to Arafat, but it was a way of putting somebody forward and keeping Arafat in the background. But to the Israelis, and I think to the Americans, this was a completely attempt to create a coup, to have a revolt against Arafat. And when that became clear, that the Israelis weren't ready to talk to anybody who even talks and coordinates with Arafat, they made his life difficult. And of course, Arafat was not willing to give up power, which he, you know, he had never been willing to give up anyway, but he was willing to share the power. Then his position, Mahmoud Abbas' position, was in trouble. Now, with Ahmed Korea, this charade is gone. He is completely coordinating with Arafat. He will have a government that has Arafat's support. And now the question is, how is it going to be dealt with by Israel and by the U.S.? Will they talk to him, knowing that he has the full support of Arafat, or not? And you know, it's a real shame that, you know, on the one hand, Israel gives the impression that they want peace, but they don't do anything about peace. They're not stopping building settlements, and they don't want to talk to the Palestinians. They don't want to give pay the real price for peace. And I don't know what they're waiting for. Their military people are telling them, just another year will crush the Intifada. And that's a real shame, because more people have to die on both sides before, again, we'll wait another year before the Israelis and the Palestinians realize that they can't crush each other and they have to go back and talk about it.
In fact, with the question of Arafat, the hawks on the Israeli side have been openly talking about assassinating Arafat. What do you think of these statements? And if Arafat is taken out by force or killed, what will that do for the current uprising?
Well, it probably will give it, it will revive it, strengthen it. I think the problem is not that. The Arafat, you know, nobody's going to live forever. And Israelis, I think, have created a monster out of him, because they don't have any answers to all the problems that they have, and it's easy to kind of find a scapegoat, and now it's Arafat. But the real issue is, if they try to kill him or deport him, they will have a bigger problem, which is, how are they going to deal with the territories? Because there will not be any more Palestinian authority to do their dirty work and to arrest and to control the populated areas. They will have to physically go in, not just for short terms as they do now, but they have to go in and control the area. They have to run it. They have to pay the money to pay the salaries of all the public officials. And we'll be back to the full occupation we had before Oslo. So I think the Israelis are in much bigger trouble than one can see from what they're saying. And I think they're trying to do something as a way of pleasing their own public opinion. And as they say, Sharon might be a good tactician, but he certainly doesn't have any strategies. And nobody knows what is the long-term strategy that Israel has.
And then I guess one final thought, because we're kind of coming to the end of our time here. Do you see a way forward to a peaceful resolution and an end to this, you know, uprising? And do you see a two-state, you know, an autonomous Palestinian state in the future?
You know, I don't know when and how we can see that. There, you know, a number of things have to happen before the idea of a two-state solution comes to life. And the number one issue that has to happen is that enough Israelis, and certainly in the right-wing Israeli government, must come to the realization that this is the only way out, that there has to be a Palestinian state. Because the alternative, and as the years go by and as the demographics balance change, the idea of a single state become much more a possibility, and certainly it will be a real problem for those Israelis who want a Jewish state. And to have a Jewish state with a Jewish majority, you can't do that if you continue to control 3.5 million Palestinians who are under your control. So it's a real question that I've always put to Israelis. In fact, I wrote an article in Forward, in a Jewish newspaper, saying exactly that. What does Israel want to do? Do they want to, as we could say, divorce us or marry us? Either they give us full rights as equal citizens in a new state for all the people, or they leave us alone and allow us to have our own state. But to continue this unhealthy relationship of occupation and occupying another people against their will is not going to last forever.
So maybe we can say an end to settlement building, opening of roadblocks, removal of the wall, and possibly a pullback to the 1967 borders might be a way forward?
Certainly, it would be a great way forward. You know, Palestinian Professor Sarah Nestabe and former Israeli Security Chief Ami Ayalon have issued a joint document which talks about that, about the future. And instead of allowing the negotiations to go on forever, they both agreed on a kind of a final solution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict by saying this is what we want, end of settlement, end of the right of return to Israel by the Palestinians, but in return, dismantle all the Jewish settlements in the areas across the Green Line and allow a Palestinian state on the 67 borders with possible adjustments on a one-to-one basis. That's the ILO and the Save ID, and I think that would have a lot of support if the leaders would come down and start talking real negotiations and not just wasting everybody's time and allowing the radicals to take over the street.
Well, we're really quickly running out of time. Daoud Kutab, I really appreciate your time, and I'll offer you this last 30 seconds for any final thoughts you may have.
Well, I would say that there is a desire for peace among Israelis and Palestinians. There's no doubt about it, that the public is quite sick and tired of the situation. It shouldn't go on anymore. There is a possibility for an honorable solution in which Palestinians and Israelis come out of this conflict we're in a way that they can live with, not in a solution that any of them like, but a solution that they can live with. That is needed. But first, we need to kind of stop the killings. And stop the killing, it has to stop on both sides, not on one side. Palestinians and Israelis must completely stop attacking each other. And you can't have any more assassinations. We can't have any more Israelis and Palestinians, you know, trading, revenge, and killings all the time. We have to have a way out. And I think that is the start of talks by ending the suicide bombings and assassinations, stopping the settlement attacks, settlement building, and then going back to the peace talks.
Well, I appreciate your time. I've been speaking tonight with Palestinian journalist Dawood Kutab. He's the director of the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, and he was joining me by phone from Amman, Jordan. Dawood Kutab, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
And that's going to wrap it up for us tonight here on Rockin' the Boat. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. Join me again tomorrow from 5:30 to 6 o'clock. I'll be back here in the studio with Rockin' the Boat. Stay tuned.